Well, it's that time, isn't it, where we start to roll into Easter. I don't know how you're feeling at this point in time, what your hopes and what your dreams are. But today we're actually going to look at the events that link through from the first Sunday through to Good Friday. Sometimes in church you hear this Sunday called as Palm Sunday, and then in other places you hear it called as Passion Sunday, where these 2 days get focus. And so we're going to look at trials and truth. Or what is the truth about Pilates? How do you judge someone? I'm now thinking about Lycra, I'm not going to go there. Is it on their appearance? Is it on their job title? Is it on what you know of their life? Or perhaps it's your relationship with them or your last memory of them. How do you judge someone? Is it by their greatest achievement or by their worst failure? At the moment, I have to say we're watching MasterChef. There are both of those. Great achievements, horrid failures. But also, great news today, Formula One starts. Yesterday was the pain for Oxford and the triumph for Cambridge. Before that are events that I'm trying to wipe from my memory on the Six Nations. Oh my goodness. For some, they're celebrating. For most, a deeply painful reminder. We look into different worlds, and we make our own judgments. We look at the decisions that are made and look at justice or a lack of it. Now, I don't know about you, but I've actually stood before a judge a couple of years ago. It was a deeply intimidating experience. You hope that you will receive justice, but you know you've got to give evidence. A verdict will be reached, and a judgment or sentence passed. Today we're looking at the way that justice is seen in the passage that we read from Mark in chapters 14 and 15. I don't know what it means to you when you think about faith, but Mark is really helpful. It's a great book to start and to ponder, because it gives us a clear daily timeline about what's happening during this week. It's a great way to cover the core points about what the Christian faith means. And we've been going through this little section of Mark for the last few weeks, and about 3 weeks ago, we started back in Mark and we looked at 3 questions. Can you remember them? I'll give you a clue. The first one started with, is it right to pay the imperial tax to Caesar or not? Should we pay or shouldn't we? That was the question that people asked Jesus. But Jesus knew their hypocrisy. Why are you trying to trap me, he asked. Bring me a denarius and let me look at it. They brought the coin and he asked them, whose image is this and whose inscription? Caesar's, they replied. Then Jesus said to them, give back to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. And they were amazed at him. We thought about the way that different people come with questions. Sometimes they are genuinely interested, but also sometimes questions aren't genuine. The questioner already had an answer in mind. This did not stop Jesus answering the question, but it did mean that actually we sometimes got a different answer from Jesus, that Jesus answered a different, deeper question. We saw the contrast from the 2 contrived questions with a final question that was from a man who was close to discovering God's kingdom. Last week we thought about the deep transformative prayer shared by Jesus in the middle of an evening of betrayal and pain. Abba Father, he said, everything is possible for you. take this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will. It's a prayer that Nathan challenged us to pray in our daily life. I don't know how you got on with that challenge this week. It's a prayer that I found really helpful for renewal and for making me ponder both what God could do and also how my will needed to be changed. Now today is a day where traditionally we celebrate the earlier events in Mark, so we go back a couple of chapters, back to Mark 11, the triumphal entry procession. And it's Jesus heading into Jerusalem, as Jenny described earlier. But I also want to think today about the later events, the trial before Pilate. The celebration of Easter week links back to the Jewish Passover feasts. Passover was a time of celebration for the Jews. But what were they celebrating? They were celebrating delivery from oppression, from slavery. And of course, we think of this, that it sounds good. Unless, of course, you are a Roman military ruler, occupying the country, oppressing the people. And from his perspective, it's not quite the same. Jerusalem was a backwater of the Roman Empire, and yet a tricky place to live. And so we meet Pontius Pilates, or, as we better know him, Pilate. I'm just trying not to look at people that are great at Latin, because I know I murdered it. But it's a challenging thing, isn't it, that here we come across a man that we know a little bit about. He ruled the area, but actually, if I was to ask you, okay, who did his job before him? Who was the fourth prefect? I had the same stunned silence. And if I was to ask who was the sixth prefect, yeah, it's pretty much the same. You see, it's not something that without Jesus has much context. You know, Pilate's job was not one that was without perks. Pilate lived actually not in Jerusalem, but predominantly out by the sea. He had a nice palace in a nice location. But of course, he also had a role. You know, when we talk about Passover, to the Romans, it was a dangerous time. It was a time of risk, a time where they were concerned that their rule may be challenged. And because of that, Pilate actually travelled from his nice seaside resort. He travelled 60 miles on his commute over a few days, and he went to the capital. It was both a practical step to reinforce the legions, and it was also a real statement of Roman power. Now, traditionally, Pilate passed into Jerusalem on the very first day of the Passover week, and we saw Pilate entering through the main gate, and it was an incredible procession. And yet this is not the procession that we would normally think about on this day. He came from the west because he had travelled in from the sea. And Jesus entered from the east. Pilate came on a horse, a conqueror with hundreds of foot soldiers around him. Meanwhile, at the other end, there's a very different parade. Just as carefully scripted, many of the details that we see described differently are about the security situation that's there. It was a revolutionary procession. We think of it in the story as a nice donkey trundling down a nice road. But actually, it was a massive contrast to the military power that was happening at the other end of the city that was also on display. The crowd was shouting praises in a way that was quite clever. You know, if you were to walk out and shout from your Bible, people might think you're strange, but they wouldn't necessarily think you were trying to overthrow the government. But as they quoted Hosanna, the Hebrew expression meaning save us, who were they asking to save? Two parades, but one crowd cheering, Hosanna, save us, and it was not for Pilate. Two parades celebrating two very different kingdoms, two different cultures clashing with different views on God, because the Roman Empire claimed that the emperor was divine. Now, last week we read how Jesus was arrested on Thursday evening of Passover week. We were left at the point where a young man fled, leaving his robe. And by the slightly scarred look on your faces, some of you can remember Nathan's sermon. If you didn't hear it, then download it. It's probably just been slightly censored. But Nathan told us that the tradition was that it was Mark who fled. And you might be wondering why he wouldn't use his own name. If this is meant to be an eyewitness account, why hide your identity? Now, this text that Mark wrote was actually circulating around Jerusalem within the lifetime of people that are in this story. There's a reason why the high priest is called the high priest. Why isn't he named? History tells us the name, but actually his family was still ruling, and his family was still killing Christians at the time that this was being written. You see, I'm sure you are familiar with the idea of a witness protection scheme, and actually some of the way that Mark is written is very much in this idea. It's not a great idea to say that you escaped arrest by the skin of your teeth, that it was so close that you lost your clothing. That's not a great way of being able to proclaim a truth. It's okay if you're chatting with your friends about saying how dangerous it was, but actually if what you are doing is giving a text that you want everybody to read and discover the good news about Jesus, then actually this is a witness statement that has life and death consequences for you. And sometimes wisdom is needed. Now we rejoin the story with Jesus being taken away to trial. In fact, if you bring the accounts from the four Gospels all together, the four different writings about this period of time, and what you discover is there are actually six trials over 12 hours. Jesus is tried six times in 12 hours. First before three different religious courts and then before three different political courts. If you want to dig deeper into that, I would say there are great resources that you can get hold of. You think of the Bible as the church Bible possibly, but also there are other sorts. There are study Bibles, and these have great guides that help you work out how all of the chronology sits together. Or if you want to just read it straight and by time, then you can get also a Bible that's ordered by time, the Bible in chronological order. And it helps you piece together some of these different statements and how this time slots together. But we're going to focus on Mark's abridged account, his shorter story. And that looks firstly at the last two religious trials, and then across the different political trials. Now, about 20 years before this story, the Romans lost the Jews and the religious leaders lost the power to convict and put people to death. Mobs still killed, but courts could not. They had to look for evidence that would actually condemn within a Roman environment. And what we get quite clearly from this reading is the evidence didn't stack up. If you look in verse 56, you'll see that many testified falsely against him, but their statements did not agree. And just in case you missed the point, you can look a little further on, verse 59. Yet even their testimony did not agree. Now, if you're rightly sceptical that this is the Jesus side of the argument, then I think you need to think about what actually happens in this text. You see, I would say to you that what you see is a change of approach. Now, according to the rules that are found in the Bible that governed the religious practices of the day and that Jesus adhered to, there was one thing that had to happen. You see, if you were charged, you didn't have to answer unless you were charged and the question was asked by the high priest. And here we are in the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin is actually like our Supreme Court. And so Jesus would have to answer the high priest. There's no silence here. And if you couldn't convict on evidence, perhaps a different approach was needed. Perhaps a confession could be achieved. In a court set up to silence claims of Messiah, there's a tragic irony that they claim to have such respect for God that they avoid using God's name. It sounds a bit strange when we read it. It doesn't flow naturally, and that's because actually the Bible in verse 63 tells us that the high priest used the term the Son of the Blessed One. But the real question he was asking was, are you the Son of God? Are you the Son of God? They were very careful about God's name. And back in Exodus chapter 3, right at the start of the Bible, we read the name by which God wanted to be known. God said to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. There are still people today who claim that Jesus was just a good person, that he never claimed to be God. I think probably they don't understand what they read here. As soon as Jesus said, I am, the high priest convicted him of exactly that claim and sentenced him to death. However, remember, they couldn't execute him, and so they had him beaten before they took him to Pilate. I don't know if you're familiar with some of the art that surrounds this. There's some nice pictures of Jesus standing before Pilate, beautifully painted, but don't ring true when you read the text. A beaten man doesn't look like that. He's a beaten man that is bound and broken. Jesus had been awake all night, but day is dawning. And that was significant. You see, when the Jews were trying Jesus overnight, they were actually breaking their own laws. They weren't allowed to do that. But they could achieve a veneer of decency by passing sentence in daybreak. You see, they looked for a loophole to achieve what they needed to achieve, a sentence that was death. But to carry it out, they had to go to Pilate, to Rome. And so we return to that parade into Jerusalem. You see, the first time that Pilate ever came to Jerusalem in his grand parade, it's recorded by historians that he brought a whole load of shields with inscriptions. They'd removed the images, but they'd left the inscriptions there. And these inscriptions were announcing the divine emperor. And they put them into Herod's palace in Jerusalem. Now, if you think about what you've just heard, how offended the Jews were by the claim that Jesus said, I am. You can see also that they would be similarly offended by the divine Roman emperor being brought into their holy city. So what happened then? Well, actually, it caused such an incredible outrage that the Jews appealed all the way up to Tiberius, the emperor. They had a deal, and part of this deal was that that shouldn't happen. And so Pilate, on his first day in his new capital city, suddenly realized he had a problem. The emperor ordered him to remove them, and they were taken back to the coast. Why was that significant to this story? Is it just an aside? I think it helps us to understand a little bit about the relationship between the Jewish leaders and Pilate. The tail was wagging the Roman dog. Now, the Roman world also started business at daybreak, and so Jesus, beaten and bound, appears before Pilate. Roman law wasn't concerned with the religious trial, and so we read, "The chief priests with the elders, the teachers of the law, and the whole Sanhedrin made their plans." And what were these plans? A plan for conviction. In order to achieve that, they needed to get a statement that Jesus was rebelling. And therefore the charge that Pilate asks about is, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Yet another of these yes-no questions, but this time from Pilate. A yes-no question for which he had no real interest. And he also received a different answer. "You have said so," Jesus replied. Jesus challenges Pilate to think about how he views this beaten, bound man. Is he really being brought to me as king? In all the previous pages of Mark's account, through the whole of the rest of that book, we don't come across the word king, but here it appears again and again. Pilate watches the scene unfold, listens to the accusations, and was amazed by Jesus. Was amazed by silence. I get that. I have to say, you know, when I'm falsely accused, unjustly accused, I can't help but argue my case. If somebody says something wrong against me, it's difficult to stop me arguing. But here is a man faced with accusations that Pilate clearly sees are motivated by the envy of the religious rulers. And yet this man remains silent. Now, in John, we learn that Jesus challenges Pilate to listen to the truth, to which Pilate responds with a memorable quote, "What is truth?" Well, perhaps there was more sarcasm. What is truth? In Luke, we learn that Pilate announced the verdict that he found Jesus innocent and then tried to dodge the political problem by sending Jesus to Herod, the other ruler permitted by Rome at this time. Herod's trial also finds Jesus innocent, and so Jesus is beaten again and returned to Pilate with another innocent verdict. Mark doesn't need to include that bit of detail in his core account. The verdict's the same. Jesus is innocent. But how can Pilate resolve this? If the religious leaders won't back down, then perhaps he can persuade the democratic vote. Follow the usual Roman custom, release a prisoner. Jesus was a twice beaten man, clearly not a threat. Why not go down that route? Now, Pilate hadn't counted on the power of the religious leaders over the crowd. Instead of releasing the convicted innocent, Jesus, he's faced with releasing the convicted murderer, Barabbas. How can Pilate resolve this? What crime has he committed? Asks Pilate of the crowd. What crime has he committed? But the crowd shouted all the louder, crucify him. Now in Matthew's gospel we get the following detail at this point. When Pilate saw that he was getting nowhere, but that instead an uproar was starting, he took water and washed his hands in front of the crowd. I am innocent of this man's blood, he said. It is your responsibility. The power of a crowd, the power of influence. Our section from Mark concludes with these verses. Wanting to satisfy the crowd. Pilate released Barabbas to them. He had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. It was not a great start to Pilate's day. In fact, it was still before 9 o'clock in the morning. If you skip through to verse 25, you read, it was 9 in the morning when they crucified him. The written notice of the charge against him read, the King of the Jews. I've thought a lot about Pilate and his life. He reminds me a lot about our modern lives. He was a man who at one level had a great life with a palace by the sea. He was also a man struggling with the demands of the situation and the pressures of the people around him. He was a man defined by his job. Yet, a few years later, he lost his job shortly after a change of boss. A new Roman emperor came, and he disappears out of history. History has little else to say about the life of Pilate, and even less that is of any good. Although there were many strange legends of his death, his end is sort of unknown. There are different claims that he killed himself on the emperor's request, that he ended up dying in Italy. But there are some strange legends about where he got buried. But none of that's known or confirmed. There's only one piece of archaeology to show that he even existed that we currently know of. It was found in 1961. A 2-foot by 3-foot block of stone. Nothing to do with a tombstone. This was simply a block with this inscription. You can see it written up there. We translate it as, to the divine Augusti Tiberium, Pontius Pilate, prefect of Judea, has dedicated this. The block was no final tribute to his memory. It just has his job. And it was recycled to build a staircase and forgotten about for 1900 years. And so I want to leave you with a final thought. How have you responded when you've been confronted by Jesus and his claims? The crowds of our day shout at us, demanding that we get rid of Jesus and his claims on our lives. Are we like Pilate, guilty of sidelining the truth because we want the approval of others? As we look to Jesus crucified, do you just see an innocent man, wrongly convicted, or do you recognize Jesus' claim on your life? Today you've heard the story of two groups of trials and seen that although questions were asked, once again, there was no real desire for answers. The final trial exists with you today and your verdict. Are you going to ask real questions? Or do you just want to get on with life and ignore the evidence? Will you listen to Jesus' silence? How will you respond to Jesus today? Pilate's trial wasn't the end. We look along the road to the cross. And we're going to stand and sing our final hymn, "When I Survey the Wondrous Cross on Which the Prince of Glory Died. My richest claim I count but loss, and pour contempt on all my pride." Please stand with me.